I'm talking today with Kim Kupinets, who is the co-founder and chief sustainability officer for GoLight. Kim, thank you for joining us today.
Olivia, thank you for having me. I love your website.
Well, thanks. I was telling you before we started, I discovered you through the B Corp website. You are a B Corporation, and I was delighted to find you because I am a big fan of what Patagonia does, and I hadn't encountered you before, and I'm an outdoor enthusiast myself, so it's particularly fun to see companies that align with my personal interests who are doing really innovative things.
Thank you.
So from that, can you describe, now that I've hinted at their outdoor connection, what GoLight is and how you started?
Absolutely. Well, my husband and I founded it in 1998, and we were very active outdoor enthusiasts, backpackers, and mountaineers. And we saw a need in the marketplace for products that were lighter. For the types of trips that we were doing, we were finding that we were having some really miserable experiences because the gear that was built and designed mainly in the 80s and early 90s had really gotten overbuilt, lots of bells and whistles, and it was bigger and better. And I think people had forgotten the fact that everything you carry in the outdoors is on your back. And we really wanted products for ourselves that would help us to have a lot more fun outdoors. And we kind of had that a few trips where there was that aha moment that said, you know, if we want it, other people probably want it as well. And we knew that the more fun we would have outdoors, and the more other people would have fun outdoors because of a lightweight experience of the gear, it would create more people who love being in the outdoors and in the wilderness, and people who would be good stewards of the planet. So, you know, we've had there's a lot of great companies out there, including Patagonia, that we've been very inspired by through the years. And we've really enjoyed over the last 11 years building GoLight, and we make a wide range of products for outdoor enthusiasts, for the outdoor athlete, and it's a full range of outdoor apparel, everything from waterproof, windproof, and insulated outerwear, performance-based layers, adventure travel wear, activewear, backpacks, tents, sleeping bags, anything that can really help improve the experience of people who are getting outdoors and or traveling the world by having products that are not only lighter on their back but lighter on the planet.
So were you an entrepreneur before? Did you have an entrepreneurial spirit? Or, I mean, it's one thing, sometimes I go about my life and I think, oh, man, I wish that this would be designed differently, or I have an idea for this. But there's a lot from having that thought process and then going to begin an apparel and manufacturing company. So what pushed you to that point?
I think I would say that both my husband and I had entrepreneurial inclinations, although neither of us had started a company before we started GoLight. In fact, neither of us had been in the outdoor industry at all or in textiles. We had come from a kind of interesting mixture of traditional business backgrounds, consulting and banking, that kind of thing, and nonprofit experiences. And in fact, my husband and I had really kind of wandered back and forth between public service and nonprofits and the for-profit world. And we always kind of had this blurred line in our heads about between the two, and that's why we kept going back and forth. And we knew that if we ever did want to start a company ourselves, that it would be a company that did good, a company that had really strong values, and that in some ways, well, on one part, would make great products that really helped people and was focused on the profit motive, but would also be doing good for the world, good for the planet, and good for the people who are involved in it. So, no, I'd say that we were entrepreneurial-leaning people, but not entrepreneurs by experience.
So you had an idea when you started that you wanted to have some social components and environmental components, and that was just, you felt, a reflection of your values and, I guess, maybe perhaps some of the deficiencies you saw in a purely for-profit world and also in a purely non-profit world.
Exactly. In fact, I'd say that what we saw in the for-profit world was companies that were overly focused on the profit motive to the point where they were doing damage. Actually, I would say that all companies on the planet, there is no such thing as a sustainable company yet. But I'd say that, you know, through the last century, companies in general went too far in the direction of being purely profit-driven. And we saw that, you know, especially in the banking and consulting realm, you know, it's really the bottom, it's the bottom line, not the triple bottom line, but the bottom line only that drives, that motivates people and drives corporate incentives and that kind of thing. Whereas on the nonprofit side, there was always, they were doing good, but there's so much inefficiency built into that model. And, you know, nonprofits spend a lot of time just trying to find resources to do the good things that they're doing, and they use those resources sometimes very inefficiently. So we really wanted to find a way to build a business that that truly subscribed to the triple bottom line. In fact, you know, how we think about that now is aiming well past neutrality. We don't want to just not do harm. We want to do actual good in the world, net good. And we want to be a well-run company that also has very loyal customers and makes a profit.
Mm-hmm. So when you started this nearly 12 years ago, it was 1998, so the landscape was a bit different than it is now. We were having lots of these conversations about good businesses. You had received an MBA. Was this something that was talked about in a university or in the course curriculum? I know that a lot of MBAs are developing sustainability programs now. And so what was your exposure to it, and also what were some of the companies that you modeled yourself after or held as benchmarks?
Well, your readers or your listeners will laugh because not only did we both do, you know, MBAs, but we both were Harvard MBAs, which kind of has this, unfortunately, negative stigma right now, and understandably so, I think, in some ways. You know, it's a great education, but I think there's been, they've been a little slow to respond to sustainability movement, something that I have wanted to have given them feedback on. Part of where that comes, you know, in my own experience doing an MBA, was that there were great learnings about how to run a company efficiently and all of the many topics that you cover in an MBA. But ethics and doing and building companies with a strong social ethos and environmental ethos, when I was going through the MBA program, was a little bit of a fringe thing. We would cover certain companies. There were case studies, for example, in the Harvard program about companies like Ben & Jerry's. But it was kind of the unusual. You know, they were kind of the outlier. And from both my husband and I, we were really inspired by case studies about companies like Ben & Jerry's. And I think that thank goodness we were exposed to those models, because it is really what influenced how we thought about how we would build GoLight. And, you know, Ben & Jerry's for sure, I would say Patagonia for sure. They were one of the leaders in the environmental movement.
So did you create a mission statement? I want to, as you and I had talked briefly about showing small businesses how you do this. And so what I'm really trying to do is to break it down into a certain process or steps that provides a general outline for businesses. And one of the things that I've been thinking and writing and talking to entrepreneurs about is the mission statement. Was that an important piece of getting your business going, or is it important now to help drive your decisions?
Both. It was absolutely essential in year one that we came out with that we had a very clear mission statement about what it is that we were doing, and that had our values embedded in it. So we had a really specific mission statement and a set of value statements from within the first few weeks of the business planning for GoLight. And over time, it's we have done a major revision, not a major revision where it's changed the essence of it, but we did about 3 years ago, we did a simplification process of the mission statement. I tend to be slightly verbose, and I drove the early mission statement and values. And when we made the decision to go beyond just being a good corporate citizen to really trying to be a sustainable company back in 2006, we took a hard look at the mission statement and values and asked the question: Is this simple to convey to other people? Is it simple to remember for our staff and for all of our stakeholders? And is it a clear representation of our values? And so what came out of that multi-stakeholder stakeholder process within the company and a few others was a much simplified version of what it is that we do and that we care about. And the mission statement now, which is, if you saw the two side by side, you'd say same company, but much clearer in the second iteration. Our mission now is to transform the outdoor athlete's everyday trail experience with gear that's light on the planet. And we have three core values, innovate, sustain, and inspire. Innovate is largely around product, although the innovation mentality and the desire to really push the edge, push the envelope on how things are done, spills over to everything that we do. The sustain piece is obviously how we think about our impact on people and the environment. And the inspire piece has been a part of our ethos from the very beginning. When I talked about why we wanted to make lightweight products so that we could inspire people to get out more, you know, when you have a miserable experience and have an 80-pound or 70-pound backpack on your back, you really don't want to go and repeat that experience very often. Whereas if you go out on a long trail and you hike for 7 to 10 days and you've got a base load of 7 to 10 pounds and the max load when you've got food, fuel, and water on your back of 25 pounds, that's a wholly different experience. And you pick your head up and you experience nature rather than this kind of behemoth on your back. And so we've spent a lot of time over the last decade thinking about how we can change the experience for the outdoor user so that it's really fun and really transformative to be in nature. And focused a lot of our efforts on getting more people outdoors.
So before, when you started, because you mentioned a transition point in 2006. So from 1998 to 2006, you had an idea that you wanted to run a company that represented your values and that had sustainability initiatives or ideals about it. What did that look like before 2006, and how conscientious were you about your different types of programs?
Yeah, sustainability, when we started in 98, sustainability wasn't really even a term that was, it was just starting to be even talked about. I mean, the practice of supply chain management and understanding chemicals in products and working to make sure that finished goods factories were using fair labor and where they were free, you know, fair, safe, and non-discriminatory, all of those much harder to get at aspects of sustainability were really nascent and not easily, I guess, discoverable by people starting companies. So what we focused on were things that were close to home. How can we give back to the community? We spent a lot of time with our staff doing community service projects and give back. We spent a lot of time supporting nonprofits and that were focused on either getting people outdoors or conservation efforts, environmental nonprofits and company and organizations that were preserving natural environments. We did a lot of give back as our management team, doing a lot of volunteering for those nonprofits on boards and that kind of thing, including our trade association and the Outdoor Foundation. We did a lot of simple things here, like recycling and encouraging people to bike to work. And, you know, these were all important to build an ethos and to have a place that was fun to work and that manifested themselves, those values, in the products. But in the end, you know, when we finally sat down and looked at our actual footprint in 2006, 7, and 8, we realized that, you know, we were barely scratching the surface of our actual footprint on the world. More than for every employee here in GoLight, working at our GoLight headquarters and in our offices in Europe, there's another 100 people who are building our products around the world. So we can treat our employees here with great HR benefits and do all those good things and get them out for community service and give them an extra week of vacation for volunteering for nonprofits, those kinds of really good things. But if the people who are building products in our name are not treated well, then we're not really walking our talk. And on the environmental front, too, we can recycle all we want here in our headquarters, but if the materials and the chemicals that are going into our products are not safe for the people building them, are not safe for the people using them, wearing them, then we're also not walking our talk. So 2006, my husband and I, I'll tell you the brief history on kind of this mind shift. We've always wanted.
I'm going to ask.
Oh, good. You know, we were always oriented around this. We knew that we wanted to have a company that truly did good in the world, but we didn't have the vocabulary or the skill set to know how to really do that. And it wasn't until, you know, kind of the 2005, 2006 timeframe when all of the the foundational literature and all of the books started coming out about the really great companies that were really tackling this issue started coming out. And, you know, we had a good first 6-7 years. We'd had a lot of great media reviews. Our sales were doing well. Our products were well received. We were having fun. We were also exhausted, you know, as you know, with having your own business, when you start a business and build it from scratch, it's endless work hours, kind of 80, 90, 100-hour work weeks. And we really needed a vacation. We hadn't had a real vacation. And, you know, here we built this outdoor company, and we hadn't had a real vacation, including outdoor time for years. So we decided we were going to take some time away, and my husband and I went to we hiked the Haute Route in from Zermatt to or from Chamonix to Zermatt over the Swiss Alps, and then we spent a little time hiking and hanging out in Tuscany. It was a fantastic vacation, but one of my big desires for in that during that time was to really take a step back from the business and say, where are we? Are we delivering on the promise of the business that we had in mind when we first started it? And are we doing right by the people that are involved in the business and by the planet? And I'd read a lot of the foundational literature, you know, Rachel Carson's work and natural capitalism and ecology of commerce. But all of those were fantastic books and had me thinking about how I could transform the company. But it wasn't until I saw Ray Anderson's book, Mid-Course Correction, and I brought it with me on this vacation for me to really digest it, where it got into kind of the nuts and bolts of what a company has to do to transform itself from the inside out. And I sat on a hammock in at a 16th century restored monastery in Tuscany, and I read it. I read it cover to cover with notes in the margins, and then I read it again. And I came back from that trip, as did my husband, just really inspired about what's possible, what a company can really do to not just pay lip service to sustainability, but can really honestly move in the direction of doing no harm and actually doing good for the planet. We're far from that as a company right now, but we're really committed to the cause. And so we came back from that vacation. We started the hard work. One of the first things we did was gain buy-in from our leadership team. We sat everybody down and said, this is what we want to do. We want to be a company that's not just window dressing, not just making a couple of green, quote-unquote, products.
When you say leadership team, was this your, did you have an advisory board, or was this just your executive
team? Our executive team, yep. We're a privately held LLC, so the owners of the company were myself and my husband and my father-in-law, who passed away in 2007, and now my mother-in-law. So it's just a small ownership team, we're a relatively young company, so we only have about 23 staff members here at our headquarters in Boulder. Wide reach, great products, but still a really small, tight team. And part of that team is this group of managers, really amazing executives that help lead this company. And, you know, we came back kind of hot to trot and passionate about this conversion or this next step of our evolution. And there was immediate buy-in. We were so excited to see that there was not a moment of like, oh, I don't know, that doesn't fit with our, you know, whatever. But they was like, no, we're on board. And we also decided.
Can I interrupt you for a moment? Did you frame it to them as, or do you remember, as a competitive advantage? Was it a business move? Was it just extending the values that your company represented? Or how was it presented, this new shift?
It was presented as a combination of what you just pointed out. And as you point out in your website, and as I just heard throughout Jeffrey Hollander's interview, doing the right thing by the planet has great business value for your company. You build better brand loyalty, you create efficiencies and cost savings throughout your company, you mitigate risk, things like the risk of exposure to petroleum, for example, and other non-renewable resources. You increase sales through customer loyalty. There's all those good bottom line business reasons to be a sustainable company, but there's also the overarching one, the one that we presented first, maybe because we're idealists, was if we can't do it, and there's very few other companies really tackling this, then we're not going to get out of the mess that we just created over the last century as a planet, as a civilization. And so we wanted to be, we we had the resources, we had the alignment of values, we had the right industry, the right consumer group, all of these kind of perfect aspects to go light making this kind of evolutionary step, including a less is more philosophy. Our foundational principle is that building less into product, having less, using less, is really more. It gives you a better experience of life. And that's a foundationally sustainable proposition. Mm-hmm. And all of those aspects, including the fact that we really felt strongly that we wanted to be part of the solution, just rang completely true with our management team, and we leaped on board.
So before that, did you consider yourself to be a system? And I agree with you when you said that there's no companies who are legitimately sustainable. We're all moving in that direction. But before this shift, did your employees, did your company feel like you were just a responsible company, or was this part of the company and employees' identification?
I didn't hear the last sentence. I apologize. There's like a siren in the background.
Was it part of the identification of the business and how the employees related to it?
I would say if we had polled the employees back then, it's such a small group of people here that we kind of talk about how we feel about things and what our view of GoLight is. I would have said that there was tremendous loyalty to the brand among our staff and a view that we were a responsible company among, that could stand shoulder to shoulder with a Patagonia or a Now or REI and say we're doing good things here and we're really trying to be responsible. But I think there was, among all of us, ignorance about what that really means. Because we are examples, even the best companies out there were doing good things, but they were skimming the surface. And now that we've really started asking the hard questions and doing the footprint analysis and saying where are our impacts, we realize that there's so much more that we could have been doing. But really, it took till mid, the mid-year of our, or the mid-cycle of our life, to that date to get to, essentially till 2006 to go, there's some things that we're not addressing at all right now, and we need to be.
So once you had the buy-in, Ben, can you take us through the process? Did you work with outside companies to audit it? What were the things that you started to tackle? And I really appreciate how you pointed out Ray Anderson's book as a resource instead of just kind of a philosophical inspiration for making this move, but a real practicality or a practical instruction book for it. So what were some of the things that you tackled?
Yeah, one of the first things was deciding that my husband and I, to that point, had been co-presidents, co-CEOs, kind of running the company together. And we decided in late 06 and 07 that if we were serious about this, which we were, that it wasn't really going to get done if it was a part-time thing for all of us, and that we needed somebody to steward our efforts. It needed to be owned by everybody and in their goals and objectives, but there also needed to be somebody that kind of masterminded the path, I guess. And we talked about it long and hard, and we ended up deciding that I would step away from the co-CEO role and focus only on sustainability. As an owner, I still focus on strategic aspects of the business, but I'm not in the, I'm not running the company anymore. My husband is doing that. And that's really important. I think companies need to have somebody, a steward that has the ear of management, that understands how businesses operate so they can understand how to make sure that whatever work you're doing in sustainability is also helping the business. It's not just for good. So we made that switch. So that was a kind of a foundational or elemental thing that we did at first. And then we sat down and we set some really big goals, or what we at the time just thought were really big goals. And they were, at the time, incredibly stretch goals. One of them was knowing what our 2000, saying that we would go from between 2008 and 2010 and having, we would have achieve a 30% absolute greenhouse gas emissions reduction off of our baseline in 2008. So over a 3-year period, 2008, 9, and 10, we would achieve 30% absolute reduction. And this is while the company was growing significantly. We, for example, in 2009, we grew revenues by more than 40% worldwide.
Wow.
So no easy task, but we decided we were going to go after it and figure out where our footprint was and start figuring out piece by piece how we would reduce those greenhouse gas emissions. We wanted to have by 2010, the goals we set were in 2006, they were off an 08 baseline. So we wanted to, because we knew we would spend the next year and a half measuring our footprint, and then we would spend the years after that to 2010 reaching these goals. So one of those goals was a zero waste headquarters. How do we go from, you know, a company that's doing a little bit of recycling to composting and recycling everything that we put out of the back door, meaning no trash, nothing that goes in the landfill. We wanted to make sure there were no restricted or banned substances in our products. And at the moment, you know, while we had lots of guidelines in our, you know, at the time in 2006, we had lots of guidelines around what was allowed in our products through working through our vendors, we didn't actually know. We'd never done chemical analysis on it. We'd never done chemical breakdowns of the materials that were going into our products to know for sure that there was nothing in our products that was on any restricted substance list. So that's the analysis we did in 2008. We wanted to make sure that by 2010 we had a majority use of environmentally preferred materials in our products. So by 2009. I think we had 2006-7. I think we had about 3% recycled materials, for example, in our whole product line by mass. And we wanted to be at a majority use, and not just recycled, but also things like BlueSign and Okotex certifications. There's a whole set of guidelines. If any of your listeners are interested, we have really specific guidelines around how we evaluate what is a quote unquote environmentally preferred material, and it's rigorous and very conservative. And you can find the details in our 2009 sustainability report on our website. But the good news is it made us start making some fundamental choices around what was built into the products that we were bringing to market. And by the way, we also made the firm decision that we would not be sacrificing performance. Our users, our consumers, are outdoor athletes. They're using our products in some really sometimes dangerous conditions out there, you know, climbing Everest, doing multi-thousand mile hikes, even just a regular trail run can turn, you know, grim if the weather turns, and we needed products that would stand up to being out there in rigorous conditions. So we said, we're going to make these environmental changes, we're going to work really hard to find these materials, but not sacrifice performance in our products. We also wanted to make sure that that we were really doing the right thing by the employees and all of our factories around the world. And so we were already doing factory audits, but we weren't as rigorous as we could have been. And so we started looking really hard at those numbers and working closely with our factory managers to make sure that our products were being built in factories that were fair, safe, and non-discriminatory. And we wanted to be by 2010 carbon neutral. These are the six goals that we set out in 2006, and we're happy to say that we either have achieved already and surpassed in some instances, or are well on our way to achieving all of them. The only one that we haven't achieved, and probably won't by the end of this year, is the zero waste headquarters. We're at about 94% diversion away from landfill, so everything about 94% of what we produce in terms of waste is either composted or recycled. And we're working on that last 60%, or 6%, and that 6% is hard to figure out. It's things like people bringing lunches to work in packaging that's not recyclable, you know, frozen lunches, that kind of thing. So we do dumpster dives, literally, to figure out what it is that's being thrown into the trash, quote-unquote, pile, to figure out how we can eliminate those things from our lives. And the other big accomplishment that we're really proud of is that from that original goal setting in 2006, over that next few year period through now, our spring 2010 product line has over 67% environmentally preferred materials by mass. and it's going to be even higher for fall 2010.
Wow.
So, you know, the long and short of that is that setting these big goals, the kind of big moon landing goals, puts a stake in the ground, and it rallies your employees to get excited about the difference that you can make as a company and how you really can, when you're thoughtful and rigorous about it, change what it is that you do and reduce your impact on the world.
So, Kim, how did you go? Those are huge goals, and they're all of them probably are very technical. How did you find the resources? Was it software or individual consultants or firms to help you take these audits and evaluate and change some of the materials and processes? And also, what were the financial resources that you had to put in to these new initiatives and to really streamlining your commitment to, not streamlining, but underscoring your commitment to sustainability?
So we have used a bit of outside help. For the most part, though, most of the goals, for example, the setting of the goals and the accomplishment of the goals has been done by our team. We signed on board to them, and then it was kind of filtered out how we would each goal was dissected to determine how it would affect each employee's job. For example, on the environmentally preferred materials front, very technical goal, but an essential goal from the standpoint of if you know that more than 60% of your footprint comes from the materials and the production of materials in your products, then if you're about reducing your greenhouse gas impact, then you've got to change your materials. So knowing that that was once took our product team, you know, they had to look hard at it and say, how do we do that? And it meant from that day forward, spending a lot of your time working with vendors and suppliers to ask hard questions. What is this made of? What is the impact of this? What's the energy use? What's the greenhouse gas impact? How does it perform relative to virgin equivalents or non-environmentally preferred equivalents? And then making at a very minute level those decisions day by day, and one by one changing materials choices and changing products so that when you get to 2010, you could actually show something for it. I'd say that for each of those goals, it was driven down in throughout our team and embedded into our company goals and our departmental goals and then into our individual staff goals. It's hard to get at exactly what the financial investment has been at some of those micro levels because it's so woven throughout how we do business now. I think the biggest financial commitment that we made was putting a full-time executive, myself, onto the task of driving the sustainability work. We've also made some fairly significant financial commitments in terms of the audits that are done, the third-party audits that are done within our factories around the world.
I was going to ask about the fair labor and how you were evaluating that. I mean, that seems it's more difficult to do. It seems like you'd have to have some type of third party who was helping.
Would
with that.
Yeah. In 2006, we didn't, and we're fortunate to have a unique relationship with the Timberland Company, and Timberland is one of the leading one of those companies in the international landscape that's on the leading edge of thinking about human rights and working with factories and working with factory management to help those factories perform well from a human rights standpoint and having factories that are fair, safe, and non-discriminatory. So we piggyback on the Timberland process and the Timberland audit system. And all of our 100% of our factories are currently audited through that system. And not just through the third-party auditors, but our design and development and product team spends a lot of time with those managers working on the management action plans and making sure that they're getting better season to season. And if there are any infringements, I guess, that are things in the factories that are not good, like, you know, our typical kind of challenge areas for factories is overtime hours and minimum wage. And if any of your listeners are interested, there's a very detailed review of these kind of general challenges that we face with these factories throughout the world in our sustainability report. But the good news is that having people who have worked on this and who are really committed to justice and fair labor as partners with us has really taken us fast down the track of understanding how it is that we can, in a positive way, in a partnership, in a collaborative way, work with these factories to make them better and make them better places to work for the people who are building our products.
That's really interesting to me. I mean, that sounds like an incredible asset. Do you think that Timberland is unique in their willingness to form this type of partnership with you? And if not, do you suggest that other companies look for similar types of businesses that they could form a relationship with, maybe who are at a larger scale than them, to try to piggyback or join in some of their initiatives and get that type of educational jump?
You know, it's a fairly unique situation for us in that we have a trademark agreement with Timberland, and that's the reason that we are able to piggyback with Timberland. In 2006, it's a complex situation, but we sold the trademark, the Go-Lite trademark, to Timberland, and they licensed back to us. And that enabled us to get some investment in growing our business. So we are kind of tied at the hip in a good way to the Timberland company. So it wouldn't be something that other companies would really be able to tap into. But there are fantastic resources out there for small and mid-sized companies that really are new to figuring out how to improve human rights performance in their supply chain. In the outdoor industry, for example, there's the Fair Labor Toolkit, which was developed as a collaborative effort by dozens of companies throughout the outdoor industry, and the Outdoor Industry Association, which is the trade association that represents the interests of our industry within the United States. And it's a free resource online, and it's a set of clear guidelines, a code of conduct that you can share with your vendors, an audit process and audit forms that you can share with your vendors, and that you can use, that smaller companies can use themselves to go about the hard work of reviewing these practices within the companies and remediating or working with the management teams to help make those factories better. You know, and there's also a lot of fantastic fair labor associations out there that companies outside the outdoor industry can tap into for not only the standards, but processes around how they can start working to improve conditions in those factories.
So as you were doing most of this internally, you were leading this effort, but it was very much broken down and understood by employees, and they were a part of helping to find solutions to reach these goals. So as I mentioned before, I think a lot of this sounds, it is technical, and there can be certain layers to it. Did you and your employees just self-educate, and do you recommend that as a path to other people in terms of looking for ways to incorporate some of the goals that you did, like carbon reduction and zero waste and product ingredients and materials?
You know, I think the answer to that really depends on the company and who's in the company. We were lucky in that a lot of the employees that we had on staff in 2006 and still true today are very environmentally minded. So we had a really good foundation of knowledge to start with. But all of our managers, including myself, of course, have done a lot of self-education, seminars, industry gatherings, the best books out there, conferences and that kind of thing, to just continually be pushing our own understanding of how we can go about doing this. But we've also had help. When we knew that we wanted to make this change in 2006, we knew that one of the most important things we could do was to figure out what our footprint actually was, both environmental and social. And so we spent 2007 prepping for, and then 2008 doing the analysis to figure out what that footprint was. And you could possibly do it yourself, but I don't know how accurate it would be. So we actually hired a really fantastic group of scientists and analysts at Five Winds International. They're an international environmental consulting firm that helped us figure out what our footprint was, carbon footprint, our chemical analysis to figure out what was in our products, et cetera. We did a lot of, and then we worked with Timberland to really do a breakdown of and then a summary of where we were from a factory fair labor standpoint, and then we kind of pulled that all together into a general view of where our footprint was. And so I'd say that every company needs to do an assessment of what is our base knowledge here. And if they're really lacking in base knowledge, then they need to take their key executives that are going to be driving these processes and get them educated, either through consultants that come in and help them look at their company and advise them and educate them, or sending them to seminars, you know, any of the great conferences, sustainability-related conferences out there. There's so many ways you can go about doing it. We were in, you know, two aspects of it. We're not a huge company, and so we didn't have enormous resources to formally educate this group. But the flip side of that was that we were so motivated and so I guess scrappy that we went out and educated ourselves in large part. And then those areas where we really didn't know what we were doing, for example, carbon footprinting, we hired experts to help us.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen financial savings? How have these initiatives and reaching them and succeeding in them helped your business in terms of financial savings? And also, do you market it differently? Do you talk to your customers about your story different than and in different ways than you had before?
Yes. I'd say it hasn't been an easy thing to measure, because we're so busy just building the business. We haven't spent a lot of time at a micro level measuring the positive financial impacts of what, both positive and expense aspects of what we've invested in sustainability. We do know that there have been specific things that we could identify. For example, operational efficiencies. When we're really careful about how we send materials between upline suppliers and finished goods factories and our distributors around the world to minimize travel distance, because that not only reduces greenhouse gas emissions, but it also saves money. And so we could identify, if we had extra staff to specifically address that, we could quantify exactly how much we've saved in both carbon and carbon equivalents and money by doing those, making those kind of decisions. Other decisions like using Skype and two things, to reduce our travel greenhouse gas emissions from the staff standpoint. We've done things like making sure that when we have a trip to the Pacific Rim, for example, to visit with several factories, we do them all at once rather than fly over, come back, fly over, come back. And not only that enables us to be really focused during those trips, it's better for the employees, so they're not leaving their family, you know, every couple of weeks. But it's also saving money and greenhouse gas emissions. We've learned how to, for example, instead of going to our factories to review some small changes to a product line that's coming down, we oftentimes will review it over Skype, and we'll sit down with their team and our team, and we'll hold up a piece of fabric and talk about what needs to change, and it's working very well. Simple things like having a desire to be a paperless office has saved us a lot of money relative to how, when you consider how much it costs to run an office, a lot of money in reduced paper purchases.
Have you noticed that as you're reducing materials and resources, and that has that reduced your cost? And have you also, something that we hear a lot and that I write about is, well, if you're producing less waste, you're paying less to have it taken away. So have you found cost savings in getting to 94% of waste reduction?
Yes, we have. Yeah, I think that's more true on the material side and the production of the products that we make. When we're really careful, for example, about making sure that we have high yield in our fabric utilization, for example, or the other way to think about it is less waste, not having as much inefficiency in how we build, how we design products on a marker or on a, you know, when you think about a, when your mother used to make a dress and they lay it out on a pattern, you want to minimize the amount of scrap that's left over when you make that dress. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, that's an area when you, and when you're careful about how you design products and how you maximize the efficiency in that, fabric utilization, that's how you start to see real cost savings from a reduction of waste standpoint. In terms of the headquarters, we pay a flat fee to a great company organization locally called Eco. What the heck's the name of it? That's our zero waste partner. Well, I'll come back to that in a second. I will tell your listeners that I'm nine months pregnant, and so my brain isn't functioning. Some things just literally just cannot come to my mind. So we pay a flat fee for pickup of whatever waste it is, but it's obviously sent to a better place, either a composting location or a recycling place. I wouldn't say that we've saved that much on that front, but we know that we're doing a much better thing for the environment and not putting things in a landfill. The other thing you asked about was what's the payback been in terms of employee loyalty, brand loyalty, and sales? And, you know, again, it's hard to get at the specifics of those numbers, but anecdotally, we know our employee loyalty is very high and brand loyalty among consumers is very high. We've been really good in the last 3-4 years about clearly and consistently communicating the message that we have about how we are thinking about being a company that's on the path to sustainability. And at multiple levels, there's a very wonderful campaign called the Therefore I Go Light campaign that is our clear and simple message to consumers about identifying with our brand, identifying with our products, and translating it to how they live their lives. You know, for example, you'll see a group of profiles of everyday outdoor athletes on our homepage, on our website, that talks about regular folks who get outdoors regularly, who live a sustainable lifestyle, who are conscious consumers, and they want to identify with companies like Go Light that reflect their values. And they each have different statements about why they Go Light. And it's just a really compelling way to, I guess, build our tribe of people that identify with what we're all about. And then beyond that, we really try to be transparent in what we're doing and where we're doing good and where we're still missing it. And if any of your listeners want to check out there's a whole section about a lot of the things that we're up to on the sustainability front on our website in the section called Meaning of Light, including the downloadable sustainability report I've talked about that we just launched in January. And it's 157 pages. They can download the shortened version of that,
yes,
or they can download the whole
that.
Thing. but the good news is it really gives you a picture, an in-depth picture of what it is that we're about. So, you know, there's multiple levels that our consumers are experiencing our brand, and I think that's really contributing to brand loyalty. And as a result, we're growing like crazy. That has its own sustainability challenges, but we feel really good about the fact that we're enabling consumers to choose a brand and a set of products that are a good reflection of their values and not choosing other things that aren't.
One of the programs that I liked that I was reading about on your website, and I'll put a link to your sustainability section and report, but was your take back program, which encourages people to hold on and to use their products as long as possible, and then if it's not, to donate them or give them away, but they also have the option of sending them to you to receive a coupon for 20% off another purchase, and I guess they could receive that discount for sending in proof that they have given away or donated a past product. So it's that just encouragement to see these as existing and living resources that don't just disappear into landfills, and trying to have a lighter approach to it. And I thought
exactly.
That was interesting. Yeah.
Very good summary of the program.
Oh boy, thank you. So Kim, I want to ask you lastly why you decided to become a B Corp. And I want to really dig at is what are the advantages for businesses to become a B Corp and what you've gained from it?
We're really proud to be a B Corporation. We've been a B Corporation since late 2008, and it's been such a terrific addition to the walk that we're walking around sustainability for a lot of reasons. One is that B Corporation has a very rigorous questionnaire and reporting or auditing process by which they determine whether or not you are the company is qualified to be a B Corporation, and they run through all aspects of the business, everything from ownership and transparency to human resources practices within the company, to human rights practices in your supply chain, to environmental practices, to give back to the community, et cetera. And it's a very informed and educated team that's assembled this group of standards. And when we went through the audit process ourselves, it was really inspirational for us because we knew that we were doing a lot of good things, but we knew that there were blind spots that we had that were areas that we just didn't know a lot about. And going through that audit process helped us to look hard at what we were doing and say, what are those things over the next 3 to 5 years that we want to change based on these questions that they asked us to be an even better company? And so we did. You know, something as simple as, great example. They asked a lot about your benefits packages for employees, and they asked what, for example, one of the things that they asked was, do you have benefits for domestic partners? And we didn't. We didn't have it in place. It wasn't as if we didn't care about it. We just literally, you know, in our small youngness over the last, since we've built the company, didn't think about it. And so it was an immediate and simple thing to do to change, to add to our benefits packages that we recognize domestic partners. And so that's, I think, kind of step one or value one to our B Corporation membership has been helping us get better as a company. You also, as a B Corporation, become part of a community of other B Corporations that is a network of people that communicate via email and conferences and gatherings and phone calls, and we inspire each other to get better every day. And because of that community, we know that I get a lot of calls and emails from people saying, I found out about you through B Corporation. So just being a part of that community is helping us inspire other companies that want to walk that walk. And the really neat thing about what B-Lab, the group at B-Lab and B Corporation is doing, in addition to certifying B Corporations, is they're doing a lot of work at the legislative level and the corporate law standpoint, state by state, to help companies that are doing the right thing, that are living by triple bottom line principles, to be recognized as a corporate status, to gain better tax status for doing the right thing. And they just had a couple of wins recently, I think in Maryland and maybe Pennsylvania. And
yeah, they had I'm from Philadelphia, so I was proud that Philly pulled through on that one. It's really interesting. I mean, that's so critical and so smart, the approach that they're taking.
Yep.
I mean, it really just brings it down to a business value and not just, it kind of takes it off the emotional table and brings it back to the tangible benefits.
Yep, absolutely.
So, Kim, I know you mentioned also that you speak with other businesses, and you've got a sense of who the listeners are for Cause Capitalism. Is there anything else that you want to leave us with in terms of things you've learned or advice, anything along those lines?
I think we've talked about it a little bit, but I would reiterate to your listeners who are, you know, a lot of managers, I'm assuming, in small to mid-sized companies, that getting on the path to true sustainability is doable. Don't be afraid of it. There's so many great resources and people and organizations and companies out there that can help you learn how to get on that path. And then just make the decisions. Some of them are hard decisions, but make the decisions day by day and set out a clear plan and a path for yourself and set goals and milestones. And when you reach those milestones, set another set of goals and milestones to reach. It's inspiring for your employees. It's inspiring and inspiring and meaningful to your consumers, and it's good for your business, and it's good for the planet and good for the people of this planet.
For more interviews about cause capitalism, visit causecapitalism.com.